Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by discussing how the media are covering the January 6 hearings, Republican politicians who are still standing by Donald Trump, and future plans to overturn elections. Yesterday, Michael Luttig, a retired conservative judge who informally advised Mike Pence, testified that Donald Trump and his supporters are preparing an attempt to overturn the 2024 election in the same way that they attempted to overturn the 2020 election. He also said Trump and his allies and supporters are a clear and present danger to American democracy. On Twitter, Stuart Stevens, a Republican who has worked on five Republican presidential campaigns, wrote, quote, "Every Republican in Congress in a leadership position has pledged to support Trump if he's the 2024 nominee. So have all but three Republican governors. It is Trump's party." End quote. He also wrote, "I appreciate Pence could have hurt America more than he did, but let's get real. He was surrounded by a plot to end democracy and called Dan Quayle, not the FBI. He didn't hold a press conference to warn. He waited to see who was going to win and threw in with them at the last moment." Kurt Bardella, a former senior advisor for Republicans on the House Oversight Committee, who now advises Democrats, also wrote on Twitter, "The cancer has spread and infected every corner of the GOP. This is who they are, and they aren't even trying to hide it anymore." So what is the real story here? What do you make of the coverage of what we are learning so far? Today, we're joined by Dan Frumkin, editor of Press Watch, an independent nonprofit devoted to encouraging political journalists to live up to the highest standards of their profession. Press Watch encourages reporters to fight disinformation more enthusiastically and effectively, especially when democracy and people's lives are at stake. Dan Frumkin has written for The HuffPost and The Intercept and spent over 12 years at The Washington Post, where he wrote their popular White House Watch column. Hi, Dan. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Great to talk to you.
Great to have you. Will Bunch is an award-winning journalist and national columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Will Bunch focuses on social injustice, income inequality, and the government. And he's the author of After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. Hi, Will. Welcome to the show. And we'd love to have you back to talk about your book.
August 9th, it comes out.
August 9th. It was so great. We'll have you on when it comes out. Yeah, well, thank you both for joining us. I know you've been following this so closely. I just want to ask you both, first off, what has stood out for you so far? Dan, why don't you start?
Well, I think yesterday's hearing was actually a really big thing and potentially an inflection point for the country and for the media. I think it did a number of different things very, very well. For one, it established some narratives that are just really hard to get out of your head once they're in there, specifically about, you know, Trump going to the rally, telling people to go to the Capitol, Pence then saying he's not going to do what Trump wants, the rally, Trump knowing that the rally is becoming violent and that the Capitol has been breached, nevertheless tweeting against Pence again, and then all hell breaking loose. So, and it also had bombshells, which, you know, what the press has always been saying, oh, there's not gonna be any bombshells. Well, there were some terrific bombshells. There was the bombshell that we have Eastman literally telling John Eastman, you know, the crazy lawyer who was pushing for all this stuff, literally telling Trump that their plan was in fact illegal, would in fact break the law, and going ahead with it anyway. And then also Eastman then asking Rudy Giuliani a few days later to get on the list for pardons. So there was some amazing stuff. And I think I saw the media coverage shift gears a little bit.
In what ways?
I think they're calling things out more. I think, you know, I was amazed that someone like Norah O'Donnell on CBS got on right after the hearing was over and said, you know, wow, democracy is at risk, you know, and it's still going on. And then two reporters are talking about the forward-looking elements of this, that how this is not a backwards issue. This is a still very much on the burner issue. And most of the news organizations eventually managed to say, get the right headline, which was Trump knew this was illegal.
Will, what about you? What stood out for you?
Yeah, I think you have to look at this these proceedings in a couple levels. I mean, in terms of what the committee is trying to do in their presentation, I mean, I think it's been nearly flawless. I mean, they came up with a plan. I mean, well, first of all, they have a goal. Their goal is, I think, to let the American public know that this is a 5-alarm fire or a, I don't know, a 9-alarm fire, whatever the highest rating of fire is. They want people to be aware that, you know, as we've been discussing, I mean, that this is just this incredible threat to democracy that that Judge Luttig described in his testimony yesterday. And so their mission was, how do we get this across to an American public that is much harder to get through to than it was in 1973 when you had the famous Senate Watergate hearings that these hearings have been so often compared to. And so they really came up with a different format. You know, it's not open-ended. I mean, honestly, this isn't really a hearing. This is, it's more of a presentation in that it's scripted, right? You know, it's formatted to fit very narrow windows of 2 or 3 hours, which is what they think the public will focus on, and to use all the best evidence from their many hours of closed door hearings to make a particular case each day. And so they're trying to lay out a case, you know, first of all, you know, did Donald Trump know that, and his aides know that they were violating the law, you know, that this plan on January 6th wasn't a legal plan. You know, how did they connect the plan to the violence that occurred on Capitol Hill that day? You know, they're going to look at this fake elector scheme and some of the other aspects of this. And each day is going to lay out a different aspect of what basically was a criminal conspiracy. So, like I said, on that level, you can't fault them. I mean, the level they don't have control over is how is the public going to receive this message? And that's the other half of the story. And that's a story we should endeavor to tell. And we being the media should endeavor to tell that part of the story. Is this breaking through to the public? And do people really understand the threat to democracy that happened that day and the fact that it's ongoing in terms of, you know, the effort to get an infrastructure in place for 2024 of secretaries and state and other people who think this type of conduct is acceptable?
To your point about that, Will, it's been interesting to read comments from people who have not been following January 6th very closely, like a lot of journalists and news junkies who say, oh my gosh, I didn't know it was this bad. I didn't know that police were killed. I didn't know people lost their lives that day. I didn't know police committed suicide after this happened. And then, of course, we have to talk about Fox deciding not to air the primetime hearings. And I watched one of their couple minute clips of a news roundup yesterday about the hearings. They never mentioned John Eastman's name. And in many ways, these are the people that you really need to reach.
Yeah.
Will,
I mean,
your thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. Well, yeah. I mean, I would say yes and no. I mean, I think you have to be realistic about what the political landscape in America is in 2022. And I think part of that realism is accepting that there's a certain part of the population that, you know, and you know, you can argue about how big it is, but there are some people you're not going to reach, you know, and you know, to the extent, in a way, Fox News not showing the hearings, which is their right to do. I mean, they have, you know, their free speech right not to air the hearings. I mean, you can argue about it from a moral point of view and from a journalistic point of view, but those people are going to be reached. But like you said, I think you made a very good point, Rose, which is that there's a lot of people out there who actually are kind of in the middle, and maybe either in the middle politically or just in terms of information. They're people who, you know, have busy lives. You know, I mean, we've just had a pandemic. We live in a country where a lot of people have to work two jobs to get by. Mm-hmm. You know, most people can't spend 10 hours a day on Twitter, right? Yeah, these people are getting information that we shouldn't have assumed they already had. You know, I think there are millions of people, you know, the TV ratings have been pretty good, right? I mean, I think 20 million people watched the primetime hearing, which is comparable to Sunday Night Football, the highest rated show on TV. 11 million people watched the daytime hearing. Again, like a very good audience. And so you're reaching millions of people who probably didn't have the full story of January 6th before this week.
And also, I've been wondering, does YouTube count in those numbers? Because every major network has been streaming the hearings online. So if you're not home, you could be watching it on your phone. You could be watching it from your computer, anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, there's a multiplier effect that we haven't even, that's hard to measure. But, right. I mean, there's a lot of talk, you know, I was 14 in 1973. So do the math. I'm 63 now. And so I became a political junkie kind of through those Watergate hearings in 1973, watching them as a teenager. And it was just a different environment. You know, everybody talks about how PBS aired those hearings. They reran them in prime time so people could watch them. But that's because you didn't have an internet. I mean, there was no way to watch highlights of the hearings on YouTube or somewhere else. So I think now there are so many ways for people to get this information in the form that they're most comfortable with, which is good. So I think the information is getting out there. I mean, again, the question is the public, you know, can the public be moved by this dramatic case that's being made?
Rose, can I go back to your point about Fox News for a minute?
Sure.
I mean, first of all, I think it's crazy to have any expectations about Fox whatsoever. And I think we need to realize that the fact that they do what they do is just how they are. They're not news. It's nothing to do with news. So I'm not disappointed that they didn't run the hearings. I'm surprised even that they did at all. But as for reaching the Fox audience and others, I do kind of think that this has a potential to be a breakthrough moment, because I think that although there are some people who are totally inside the bubble, there's still an awful lot of folks who are influenced by what they see on more mainstream media and what they hear from other people. And I think that you know, after January 6th, there was so much news running around that there wasn't a coherent story that emerged like on one day. A lot of news organizations did fantastic work, you know, explaining what happened. But there wasn't like a moment of revelation for the general public. And like you said, a lot of people haven't been following this like us junkies have. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is the moment. Maybe this is the moment that people start to talk about it again. You know, in grocery stores, wherever they run into people, I'm just hoping, you know, I hope that your audience will like bring this up again now with people who they maybe didn't bother to talk to for a while, because I think this could be a seminal moment.
Well, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about what you've seen so far and how the media are covering this, but also Republican politicians still standing by Donald Trump, future plans to overturn elections, Republicans who were at the January 6th insurrection are winning their primaries, so they're going to be on the ballot in November. So what are your thoughts about media really connecting all of these dots? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. We got an email from Sue who says, I think it's clear and obvious to non-Trump supporters who are paying any attention to these hearings and who witnessed video of it as it happened that he and others are guilty of heinous crimes. But I think most people are wondering if the law will actually do anything with this information. The crucial question concerned Americans have is, why does the DOJ seem hesitant to commit to pursuing indictments against them? What, if anything, do you know about investigations they might be developing? Dan, do you want to take that first?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I do know is that the Department of Justice takes a long time to build cases like this. So it's not necessarily a sign that they're not investigating it, that we haven't heard anything. That said, it's all up to Merrick Garland. And this guy has proven himself time and time again to be conflict averse, really kind of weak-willed, So this is, you know, I'd say the signs are not particularly great. And that's another reason why I think these hearings are so important, because ultimately they are both laying out what is obviously a crime. And they're, I think, hopefully we'll get people talking about this and encouraging, you know, in every conceivable way, encouraging DOJ to act.
What do you think, Will?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that. I mean, I think the most important point, which Dan just made, is that I think one of the main purposes of having these hearings, you know, having them the way they're being held and maybe arguably when they're being held, is to build public support for the idea that crimes were committed here at the highest levels. You know, that if Donald Trump and his associates like John Eastman and Rudy Giuliani and you know, Steve Bannon, if those people were to be indicted at some point in the near future, that it wouldn't come as a lightning bolt out of the blue, that instead these hearings would make that conspiracy so evident that large swaths of the public would be clamoring for this, you know, that people in the average public, you know, that the guy in the supermarket that we've been talking about is saying, how come the Justice Department isn't doing anything? You know, I mean, I think a goal of the hearings is to get people into that mindset. And one thing, and this also ties into what we were talking about earlier with Fox, one thing I would note about the hearings that's been fascinating is, if you'll notice, is this entire case is being presented almost by Republicans in the sense of, you know, they're only calling witnesses who have bona fides as conservatives, like Judge Luttig, for example, is a perfect example, but and members of Mike Pence's staff and other people who are conservative lawyers and Bill Stepien, they're all Republicans, you know, saying that, you know, that we were on team normal and that the Donald Trump was the person who went off the deep end. And much of the questioning is being done by people like Liz Cheney. And I think the outside questioner, the former U.S. attorney they brought in yesterday, was also a Republican. So they're really going out of this way to, you know, to twist that scale. So it appears to be nonpartisan. And again, to help build that support and also maybe to help make that case to Merrick Garland that an indictment wouldn't be seen as a partisan, you know, political indictment.
You know, Will, I think that's a really, really good point, the sense that in a way what this is doing is not, obviously it is laying out the criminal case, but it's also setting the stage for a criminal indictment that wouldn't come out as a surprise or as partisan or as you said, a lightning bolt. That's a really interesting point, because I don't know that Merrick Garland's going to be influenced by anything Congress does. I think he's scared to death of being seen as, you know, a partisan hatchet man. And that's, you know, that he doesn't want that to be his legacy. That's the way these people's minds work.
And you know, I mean, here we are, right, talking on the exact 50th anniversary of the Watergate break, which is pretty momentous, and a day I never thought I would see as a teenage Watergate geek. But you know, on that anniversary, and as somebody who, you know, somebody who's old enough to have experienced Watergate in real time as it happened, you know, it took 2 years to build that case against Richard Nixon, and you had a very similar process. I mean, when the Watergate break-in actually occurred, and it occurred during the 1972 presidential campaign, people just didn't process it right away, or just didn't think that it could go all the way up to the White House, even though there were signs very early on that it did, you know. And the Senate Watergate hearings that you had the next summer made people realize just how widespread the corruption was. And even then, it took another year after that to painstakingly make the case that finally forced Richard Nixon out of office. And so you could argue that we're seeing a very similar process to Watergate here, in that it takes 2 years to really drill that kind of level of public awareness and then public support.
And one more piece of news to add to this, to Sue's question about the DOJ. Politico reported yesterday that the DOJ revealed a deepening rift with the January 6th House Select Committee accusing the panel of a failure to share its 1,000 witness transcripts. Department officials say those documents would aid the prosecution of people who breached the Capitol, including leaders of the Proud Boys. The DOJ says it's critical that the panel provide prosecutors copies of the transcripts of all of its witness interviews. What do you make of this, Dan?
Oh, I think it's such a classic Washington story that But then again, I actually really agree with DOJ that the committee should release its information, and not just the DOJ. I mean, they, as Will was saying, this is a presentation rather than a hearing. They have the information. They've figured out what it means. Why are they releasing it, you know, bit by bit, like it's some, you know, like it's some series on HBO? I say dump it all and let us, you know, binge watch on like it's on Netflix. I just think it's crazy that they're not releasing this information, and especially the DOJ. What the hell?
What about the public's role in all of this? Art just wrote in and said, I think DOJ may not act unless it hears from the public in massive numbers. Politics is not a spectator sport. We should be demanding our organizations organize our outrage into activism that will make it impossible for the DOJ to ignore the obvious fact that Trump tried to overthrow the election. Recently, we had The Nation's Elie Mystal on, and he said, I do not think there will be criminal accountability unless there is a public outcry demanding that the DOJ take the ball over the finish line. Will, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that may be true. I would note that one thing about Watergate, and Watergate occurred at the end of it, period of intense activism, right, where you had gigantic anti-Vietnam War protests in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. And you actually didn't see that in Watergate. I think the public outrage was voiced enough just in general ways and through public opinion polls that I think the message got through. Certainly you have not seen any effort to organize, you know, say a march on the Justice Department or anything of that level. You know, I mean, I think too much of the people that we called the resistance during the Trump years, you know, there was a fear that these people would go back to brunch, and not all of them have, but some of them did, you know, and it'll be interesting to see at the end of these hearings, if anything more on the activism front, because I do think in this case that could move the needle, especially when you have somebody like Merrick Garland who does seem to be so reluctant and so diffident at times.
Dan, do you know of any activist groups trying to put pressure on the DOJ or any plans to do so?
I mean, there's a lot of stuff on social media. I mean, I think it'd be great, but I don't think that's going to move Merrick Garland's needle. I think Merrick Garland would actually, you know, say, I won't be pressured by external to do anything. Yeah. What I think will matter to Merrick Garland is if he thinks that most of the public will think that it was a reasonable decision that he made. And so what I'd like to see, frankly, is more interviews with like independents saying, yeah, sure. It looks to me like he's guilty. Why isn't the Justice Department interviewing? Because I think that the angry left, unfortunately, they're deaf. They're just deaf to it.
Well, and what's amazing, I just have to say, some of these tweets by these former Republicans, I mean, you cannot tell they're former Republicans unless you really read the bio. They are expressing more outrage than the majority of Democratic politicians, with the exception of people like Bernie or Adam Schiff. But I mean, Kurt Bardella is going off on Twitter. I didn't know this guy used to work for Republicans. You know, you've got Stuart Stevens, Steve Schmidt. I mean, these guys speak with such outrage. And in some ways, they go on the cable shows and they sound angrier than Democrats.
Rose, I have to say, I live in Pennsylvania, and we just had our gubernatorial primaries last month. And Doug Mastriano, who is kind of makes Donald Trump look like a moderate, to be frank. I mean, he's way out there. He's QAnon adjacent. He's a Christian nationalist who, you know, supports an extreme abortion ban and basically supports the ability of state legislatures just to say whoever they want can have the state's presidential electors, you know, no matter who got the most votes. So, I mean, he would support that. He supported that in 2020 when Joe Biden won the state. He wanted to give the state's electors to Donald Trump. And so anyway, he won 44% of the vote and a landslide victory. I mean, it was a nine-candidate field. So with 44% of the vote, it was a landslide victory. This guy is the face of the Republican Party today in Pennsylvania, which is, you know, first of all, I'm going to state that Joe Biden won in 2020. It's also the state where the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, et cetera, are from. And this guy, who is an anti-democratic force to be reckoned with, and they just released the first statewide poll, and he's within the margin of error in the governor's race in Pennsylvania. So I think that's the reality of the Republican Party today. And I think the insiders like Stuart Stevens, and, you know, I applaud them for their stance, and Steve Schmidt and people like that. But like Dan said, they're a small minority.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll talk more about that in just a couple of minutes. Will Bunch is an award-winning journalist and national columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Dan Frumkin is editor of Press Watch, an independent nonprofit devoted to encouraging political journalists to live up to the highest standards of their profession. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are discussing coverage of the January 6th hearings, Republicans who are still standing by Donald Trump, and future plans to overturn elections. We're joined today by Dan Frumkin, the editor of Press Watch. They encourage reporters to fight disinformation more effectively, especially when democracy and people's lives are at stake. Will Bunch is an award-winning journalist and national columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, with a focus on social injustice, income inequality, and the government. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Before we get back to calls, Will, you were talking earlier about Mastriano, who is running for governor in Philadelphia. And I just wonder what your thoughts are about how the media from here on out should be covering these candidates that have either won their primaries or plan to run, who either attended January 6th, are spewing, you know, QAnon conspiracies, are saying that the election was stolen, because I've heard them be referred to as, quote, controversial. So, Dan, what are your thoughts on that? You follow this very closely.
Yeah, this has been one of my biggest pet peeves about political journalism in the last couple of years, is that, generally speaking, and I think, you know, Will can talk to the Pennsylvania campaign, but generally speaking, it's like there's two different storylines that are being told in the newsrooms, and they don't intersect. And one is that Republicans are going to win in, you know, in the midterms. They're going to sweep. All the numbers show they're going to win. And the other is, oh, by the way, if Republicans, you know, and democracy is in danger, because the Republicans have basically decided they would like to from now on call elections themselves rather than let the public do it. And what irritates me is the daily coverage doesn't put that context, essential context, into its stories. So when you are writing about this guy, you ought to write, he has basically, you know, campaigned with the promise to steal the election, any elections that Republicans don't win down the line. The disconnect is, it's because they're afraid of being called liberal or what have you. But the disconnect is really tragic, because you can't be writing glibly about the fact that people like Mastriano are going to win if you care about democracy. You just can't.
Will, what do you think?
I mean, in a way, it's a dilemma, although I think, as you said, you know, the things that you described, the fact that, you know, somebody like Mastriano took part in January 6th, or that they believe in, you know, overturning election results or they have a connection to QAnon. I think you just can't say those things often enough. And, you know, like you and Dan said, you know, calling them controversial, doesn't cut it. But I think you have a duty to explain to people the ways that these people threaten democracy. And, you know, if it's tied factually to what they did, you know, on January 6th or some other time, or tied factually to what they said, you know, it's still objective journalism. You know, it's just truth telling, and it's not fudging it by calling somebody who wants to overthrow democracy, you know, controversial or edgy or whatever. There's interestingly, there's been a lot of controversy just in the last week or so. I mean, there's been a lot of turnover at the top in big media. And, you know, I think some of that is because ratings have plummeted, right, in the post Donald Trump era. And that's maybe sped up some of the turnover in some places. But a lot of people are watching the transition, for example. Well, two places, really, the New York Times, which just welcomed its new editor, Joe Kahn, and also CNN, which has a new leader. And at CNN, the new head of the news division, or well, CNN is a news division. The new head of CNN, there was a headline the other day that has banned the use of the term "the big lie," which has been used a lot by journalists to describe, Donald Trump's insistence that he really won the 2020 election, that there was massive fraud. And I mean, the thing about that, two things. One, I mean, clearly it's a lie because every court, every recount, every journalistic investigation has shown there was absolutely zero voter fraud beyond the minuscule levels that you would see in any typical election. Now, the phrase "the big lie," I mean, sure, it's a slightly loaded phrase because it refers to, you know, this idea that we can trace back to, you know, Nazi Germany and other authoritarian movements that, you know, that if you tell a huge lie and you tell it often enough, you know, the public won't be able to resist it. And, you know, how is that not Donald Trump's strategy, right? So to me, you know, when he's telling his news people not to use the phrase "the big lie," he's not promoting objective journalism. I think he's subverting truthful journalism when he does that. And I'm concerned that you're going to see more of this. I mean, we're really at a pivot point for the media right now in whether they can acknowledge and talk candidly about the threat to democracy. And what we're seeing right at the moment is not good.
Well, unfortunately, we have to move on to our next segment, but we'd love to have both of you back because we've got four or five hearings left. So there is still a lot to uncover. And thank you so much for providing analysis and for the great work that you both do. Dan Frumkin is the editor of Press Watch. Will Bunch is an award-winning journalist and national columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, Rose.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you. And I just want to mention a few things here. A few of our listeners have sent in a New York Times op-ed by Jamel Bowie. "The gerontocracy of the Democratic Party does not understand that we're at the brink." We'll definitely focus on that in the near future. Also, because we are spending so much time on January 6th, we're missing a couple of really important pieces of information. I'm reading from Politico right now. The Senate Armed Services Committee has endorsed a $45 billion increase to President Biden's military spending plans in its annual defense policy bill, blowing past the administration's Pentagon budget for a second straight year. So this is on top of the $800 billion that Biden has already requested. The Senate wants another $45 billion for the military and weapons contractors. So that's really important to mention. And then this is hardly getting any attention. Tomorrow in Washington, D.C., there's going to be a Poor People's Campaign in D.C. According to the Poor People's Campaign, there are 140 million poor and low-income people in the United States, and they are going to be marching on Washington. They're calling it a low-wage workers' assembly and moral march. Yes, this deserves so much more attention, but we had to really dedicate a lot of our time this week to January 6th, and we'll definitely cover this and do our best in the coming weeks. But January 6th is definitely going to take a lot of airtime, but we wanted you to know about those stories.